I'm a graduate student in social anthropology, so I've compiled some stuff that I collected some data during two exploratory trips to Greece, and tomorrow I'll fly to Volos, where my field site is, to spend a year there. So I'm just going to throw some stuff at you and we'll see how you react. So just to say it, at first I'm financed by the Academy of Sciences in Austria, and it's part of a larger interdisciplinary project on valuation and normative orders, let's say. There's a political scientist studying democratization movements in Austria, and a social anthropologist looking at valuation practices of corporate social responsibility workplaces in Turkey. And the last one is my study on, it's like everyday economics, market-based as well as non-market-based production circulation in Volos, Greece. So here we are. That's, I think, some statistics about Greece nowadays that we are sort of used to see also in the media, and also especially during since last Sunday's election and all the talks and negotiations now. It might be another interesting study, like the valuation practices that lie behind these historical configurations of numbers like GDP or debt to GDP ratio and so on. And also now these struggles between political parties that actually sort of legitimize these numbers by their negotiation work they're doing. So there's no really anti-party at the moment in Greece, but there's a party that sort of interprets these numbers in other significant and meaningful ways. So, but that's not what I want to talk to you about today, but the everyday economic crisis, as I sort of framed it here. And this paper is concerned with the question how formal low to middle income families, extended families, households, you will see what I mean by that, cope with the economic situation, through what means, and whether new social positions within kin networks emerge. So I will focus on one case of Calypso and her extended family. I think that's good to illustrate what's going on at the moment in Volos and gives us the chance to discuss about this case. Okay, Calypso, she's 40-something, that's not Calypso. And she's not called Calypso. Of course, but I wanted to give you an idea, so just a face to what I'm saying, and I'm sorry to her for doing that. She's 40-something, unemployed at the moment. She used to be a business owner, owning a kiosk, selling like a newsstand, I guess. But this was closed due to the high social insurance costs that came with austerity measures, which is quite common in Greece, that businesses are deregistered because of sort of they had to pay a lump sum tax on expected incomes, which they do not read at the moment at all. So that's what's happened. Okay, her husband is working in the fire department of the city and earns around 700 euros per month, depending on his shift. They earn property and olive trees, and there's another agricultural tax sort of that also charges a lump sum of tax for the expected income, whether or not they are sort of selling the olives or the olive oil. So even if it's only for subsistence consumption, they would sort of, yeah, okay. We can talk about the strategies behind these things as well. Okay, they have a 5-year-old daughter that was born during the crisis, which is also sort of points to interesting things that I'll return to later. There's an aunt. I'm just sort of telling some of the positions within the extended family so you get an idea of the issues that are around. There's her aunt has extensive debt on her mortgage and she faces several lawsuits. Calypso is sort of assisting her by learning about tax laws and economic laws in order to sort of mediate between her aunt and the court appointed lawyer, who is apparently not really interested in sort of winning the lawsuits because it would be impossible. Her mother, that's also not her mother, but About this interesting, she used to own a shoe shop. It was also deregistered in the same process as I told before. And the shoe shop is sort of, she's pensioned and earns 700 euros a month, I think, through pension. But this shoe shop is still like a center of several other economic activities. Like here you see soup kitchen, I think it's called a soup kitchen, like welfare, handing out food to people, to needy people. And as a multi-activist, she also runs an alternative currency network. And both these organizations are based in the shoe shop. This also will be significant later. The father of the husband is pensioned as well and is paid 900 euros. So why is this important? Because, and I can skip some of my talk because we talked about income pooling in the talks before as well. What was interesting in this case is the family started the extended family. So the household level would tell us only that there's a man that earns from being employed in the fire department, the woman not, and they have a child. But here there are several other people involved whose income is pooled by Calypso. This was done before the crisis as well, but with the onset of the crisis, these incomes, remember, two of them are transfer payments, so pension, and one is public wage. So all three incomes of this family were quite affected by the austerity measures, but the costs stayed almost the same. So what happened there was Calypso shifted her bookkeeping techniques from keeping separate accounts before the crisis, or what they say refer to as the crisis, in where she sort of paid the bills of one income, but with, you get the point. And then afterwards she pooled it, so there was really one common pool, and that required her also not only to sort of engage in these techniques and practices of bookkeeping, also in evaluating material justice. So what is important for the family to buy, which consumption practices or items, products are worthy or valuable for the whole family and which are not. So as you can imagine, the second point that changed with the crisis was the relations, the power relations within the family and these people. And Calypso was faced with suspicion by the others because they felt sort of that their decline in purchasing power was not really sort of only because of the crisis, but maybe also because Calypso did something wrong with the bookkeeping and so on. So there was quite this suspicion, and it resulted in a sort of a joking relationship between those earning and Calypso, who was pooling the income. So the father of her husband, he went to the soup kitchen just to run a joke about him not being able to eat something because Calypso did the income pooling wrong. Yeah, so you can sort of feel where this is getting. Of course, for her, sort of the skills that are needed to run this income pool are quite substantial, I would say, and the problem is that she can't make ends meet. So it's just too expensive and there's too little income, so she needs to get sort of remittances from relatives that live away, or credit, small borrowings from friends and relatives, and it is quite unclear who has the responsibility for these debts, because actually they're used to help with the expenses of the whole family, but she got it, and so it is a quite an ambivalent situation she's in. Okay, that was the first point on the income pooling, which I find is sort of revealing in this extended family. The second point I want to make is on avoiding the impression of poverty, because that's something that's quite important for this family. It used to be middle income, and we're used to displaying consumption goods like iPhones and so, feeling as market actors that are productive, achieved something, and so on and so on. And now as this has changed and their social status is downgraded, it is, but they want to avoid the impression that it is. And there's two techniques I wanted to share with you. And the one thing is related to clothing, and that's why I told you about the clothing exchange, the mother runs. Because what happens here is Calypso helps with sorting the clothing and stuff like that, and in exchange she can hand pick some items for her daughter, for instance, to like give the impression that she has new clothes every few months or even weeks. So there's a humanitarian logic involved, of course, because these the clothes are for the needy. But in sort of helping organize it, she gets into a mode of where this is sort of a payment for the work she's doing for this exchange. And so she feels she deserves it, and it's not something that she's just given. The second technique is with the alternative currency network, and it works almost the same like with the clothing, but there's another thing to it. She gets paid in the alternative currency for administrating the network. And the second thing is, as both these philanthropic activities are based in the shoe shop of the mother, they use some of the income of the organizations to pay for electricity, computer, internet access, and so on. So on the one hand, they need it for running these activities. On the other hand, it's also something by which she can, Calypso can sort of not pay for the internet in euros, which she doesn't have, but through sort of making it the headquarter of the currency in the shoe shop of the mother. Sure. I'll skip some things. The last point worth mentioning, I think, here in avoiding the impression of poverty is something that is quite common in Greece nowadays. Some people, or there's quite a number of people that are indignant with the indignant. So there's this notion, this is from Theodosopoulos, so it's not my. But, and this is the same for Calypso. She's, even if there are a lot of protest movements, political parties and so on that are aligned with actually her situation and the problem she's having, she refuses to take part in them, because she's sort of someone who is successful in terms of economic activity, so she will not be so unproductive as going to demonstrate on the street, but rather she will do something for it. And this is a narrative that runs through a lot of the talks we had. Of course, and I don't need to fully explain this point, a lot of the labor that she is doing and that is important and necessary for the subsistence of the extended family is of course not paid, is reproductive labor. And this points to something I've mentioned earlier also, that the value at the value of this income in the state-issued currency here is much more important than her actually work she's doing for the other family members. So, sorry for the terrible Austrian English, but I hope I get it across. Like with the example I told you about the joking about her income pooling, I mean, this is quite a skilled activity she's doing, and she's learning all the time in how to do it better, how to manage different sort of bank accounts, credit lines, and so on and so on. But she's treated by the family members as just like kid stuff. Yeah. And so I guess this is also important in taking something like a new substantive and feminist approach towards modern day or these days capitalism in Greece. And I propose to sort of frame this also as a brokerage position. Yeah. I was more enthusiastic about that point in the abstract than okay. So that's it for now.
Thanks, Andreas.
Thank you. I really found that very interesting. I have two comments One is, to what extent can we speak of gender and family relations as part of Calypso's situation? You've sort of hinted at that,
mm-hmm.
in that she stands between, as a broker between all these people. But is it not significant that she's a second wife, first of all, and she's someone who's managing kin by marriage? And that leads to me as a second point. You've spoken about her as a broker position. Might it not also be productive to think of her as a moral arbiter and someone embedded in what amounts to a moral economy? And perhaps, as you're already thinking in substantivist terms, there'd be a neo-substantivist. We can talk about this as her being the determiner of what counts in the moral economy of the extended family. Because really, we're talking about duties, responsibilities, and obligations, and at the same time, material justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if that was so much a question
mm-hmm.
as a kind of
mm-hmm.
comment on how to, things to think about
mm-hmm.
in going forward.
Thanks a lot. The larger project and also my PhD project does frame certain aspects of what's happening there as a moral economy,
mm-hmm.
especially with the alternative currency on which I'm focusing more in my PhD study or in the study.
Mm-hmm.
Totally so. I mean,
yeah,
it is. I just wanted to point here more to issues on sort of the asymmetric relations between these spheres of exchange, because the euro, like the formal market, state-issued currency market sphere, is at the moment a heavily contested one. She can sort of substitute some of what she needs in terms of, in order to distribute and according to her moral valuations and so on, but she needs the euros. That's it.
I can ask one.
Yes.
I was thinking about, I thought it was so interesting when you spoke about the formal and informal economies. I mean, you could think about it as that, and
mm-hmm.
that the formal economy gives status, right, if you earn mm-hmm. money through that, but not through the informal. And on the same time, the formal economy is very much, you know, also in, associated with the state. You pay taxes, you do what you're supposed to do as a citizen. And what I understood from your paper, I mean, that's the type of thing you try to avoid on the same time, right? So it's
mm-hmm.
sort of going back and forth there between. I thought that was interesting.
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting for me coming to Greece, and I guess it's something on heuristic strategy also in anthropology to go there and sort of be a stranger to this society, if you want. Because I couldn't really see any clear-cut boundary between formal and informal here, but rather certain networks of relation that work in these modes, sort of. Even the tax police is in there when she looks at the clothing exchange and the alternative currency, whether these are sort of activities that could be subject to formal tax laws,
mm-hmm.
which the austerity regime sort of is requesting. Get people into the formal economy so we have a bigger GDP and we can report growth and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all those things going on that are social relations, ties or whatever that are materially sort of significant.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I understand. Sorry, Shireen and Ness.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I just had a very minor point, actually. Well, maybe it's very important. But how do you think they reacted to you, or do you think it might have influenced the way they spoke to you, the fact that you are from Austria? Are you from Austria?
Yeah,
yes.
Austria.
So do you think that might impact?
It does, and it's an important point to say. Most of the talks revolved around the difference between Greek economics and the way they perceived the Austrian way of doing things. Like extremely straight, calculative, and so on. That would be me, not them. So it was difficult to, in the data itself, to try to find out which of the arguments sort of they did. And it was the remarks on the side mostly, or when I had the interviews and then the husband's father came in to complain about something, where I got to this point of trying to see the difference between those two things. explaining Greece to an Austrian anthropologist and the way the family is actually dealing in their everyday economic life.
Thanks, I thought it was a really interesting paper, really rich. I'm interested in the stuff around alternative currencies, because I think in lots of European countries and on the left, the kind of revival or the kind of growth of alternative currencies in Greece is seen as this fabulous progressive moment, like maybe Greece's kind of response to austerity can develop sort of things like Bitcoin or alternative currencies more generally. But in your paper, I get a strong sense of it being used in as part of these strategies of appearance management. It's precisely because it's kind of hidden in some ways, or it can kind of operate in parallel, that it functions so well in those terms. I wondered if you had any further thoughts or preliminary thoughts on alternative currencies and their significance.
Yes, I do. Here I sort of had it more in this misrecognition argument, maybe that's like Bourdieu, the way that they are actually doing this in order to be economic actors, but the value they get from it is not so substantial. That was the argument here. I see this surge also in the literature, and sort of, I think it corresponds more to the hope of those that are researching Greece than what actually is happening there. I mean, this was currency network that actually is called TEM, so you can Google it. There's a lot of emails, YouTube videos, CNN, BBC, everyone was there. And when I was there, I think there were three MA students, one anthropologist from Japan, and all Googled it, like this alternative currency Greece. They found out about it and went there, so they are quite sort of, they don't have a liaison manager, okay? But they have 800 members, and they're around 50 or 60 of them are active, which is a big problem for them. And it seems that I was not really able to buy something in the currency on the 2 times a week market, because everyone was, just take the DVD, it doesn't matter whether it's 1 or 5, 10, whatever. So I got the idea that it's more a relational work maybe as well than an economic power, that it's rising. And this narrative, sort of, I'm quite suspicious of that. Because
it's really an interesting corrective to kind of left fantasies about Greek.
It is, and there's some other ones like the potato movement, you might have heard of that. A classic left cut out the middleman strategy, but they're selling huge amounts of potatoes, olive oil. So in the city of Volos, there are 120,000 inhabitants. It's embarrassing now, but just take this. And they sell something like 40 tons of potatoes every 2 weeks, together with a lot of other agricultural products. So there is some answers to some of the problems, but in currencies, I don't see it.
I'm going to ask the last question. You spoke about...
For some...
Of course.
Thank you for the presentation. What do you think are the main motivation for these people at the beginning for creating this pooling income management instead of not doing so?
From what they have told me, so that's one part of the answer. It was easier for them to do it. Like the parents' generation, it's mostly them, their income that is pooled. They didn't really want to have to do anything with it. And there was no, from what they told me, there was no economic reason in terms of we needed to pool the income or something like that. It was just they retained 200, 300 euros for themselves, for their expenses and so on, and it was just easy to let their bills be sent to another person to settle it. It became more important when the problem arose that the income was way too short for the expenses.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andreas. So, our fourth speaker for the morning session.
I'm sorry, I didn't
know.
No,
I didn't see him. No, no, it's fine, it's fine.
He was resistant for something.
Okay, I haven't seen him. That's fine, I'm glad you did.
Okay.